shoemaker. True. So, carpenters and bronzesmiths and a whole lot of skilled workers of that kind will become partners in our little city and make the place quite crowded. They will. All the same, it still won't be all that large, even if we add cattlemen, shepherds and other herdsmen, so that the farmers can have oxen for ploughing, and so that builders as well as the farmers will be able to use animals for carrying materials, and so that weavers and shoemakers can have hides and wool. It certainly won't be a small city, he said, if it contains all that. That's not all, I said. It will be more or less impossible to locate the city itself in a place where it won't need imports. Quite impossible. So it will require yet more people in addition to bring it the things it needs from some other city. It will. What is more, if their agent goes empty-handed, taking nothing which meets the needs of the people from whom they are importing the things they are short of, then he will come back empty-handed, won't he? I think so. So, in their own economy, the citizens must not only provide adequately for themselves, they must also produce the right kind of goods, and in large enough quantities, for the people they need to trade with. Yes, they must. So, our city needs more farmers and more workers in other occupations. Yes, and more agents as well, presumably, the ones who are going to do all the importing and exporting. These people are merchants, aren't they? Yes, so we shall need merchants as well. Definitely. And if our trade is by sea, we shall need a large number of other people as well, experts on seafaring. Yes, a large number. What about trade in the city itself? How will each group share its production with others? That, after all, was our reason for forming an association and establishing a city. Well, obviously, he said, by buying and selling. That will give rise to a marketplace and a currency, a unit of exchange for transactions. Undoubtedly. But when the farmer or member of one of the other occupations brings to market part of what he produces, he may not arrive there at the same moment as those who need to exchange goods with him. Is he going to sit around in the marketplace, taking time off from his work? Certainly not, he said. There are people who identify this need and make themselves available for this activity. In a well-run city, they tend to be the weakest physically, those who are useless for any other kind of work. They have to wait around there in the marketplace, receiving goods in exchange for money from those who have something to sell, and then again money in return for goods from all those who want to buy. So, this is the need, I said, which brings dealers into our city. Don't we call people dealers if they sit in the marketplace offering a selling and buying service, whereas those who travel round the cities we call merchants? We do. And there is still another group of people, I think, offering a service. We certainly would not want them as partners or associates for their mental attributes, but they possess physical strength suitable for manual labour. This they offer for sale, and the price they put on it they call their hire. That, I imagine, is why they in turn are called hired labourers. Isn't that right? Yes. So hired labourers, it seems, will also go to fill up our city. I think they may. Well then, Adeimantus, is our city now large enough? Is it complete? Maybe it is. In which case, where exactly are justice and injustice to be found in it? In which of the elements we have examined have they made their appearance? Speaking for myself, Socrates, he said, I've no idea, unless I suppose it is in some sort of need which those elements have of one another. I think that may be the right answer, I said. We must examine it without hesitation. Let's look first at the way people will spend their time in an economy of this kind. Won't it be that they produce bread and wine and clothing and shoes? They will build themselves houses. In summer, they will go about their work lightly clad and barefoot, and in winter, they will be properly clothed and shod. They will live on barley meal and wheat flour. kneading and baking these. They will have fine barley cakes or wheat loaves served on reeds or fresh leaves. They will eat lying on straw beds covered with bryony and myrtle. They can live very well like this, they and their children, drinking wine after their meals, wearing garlands on their heads, and singing the praises of the gods. They will live quite happily with one another. They will have no more children than they can afford, and they will avoid poverty and war. At this point, Glaucon interrupted. No art of cookery, apparently, for these people you describe as living so well? That's a good point, I said. I forgot that they will have the art of cookery. Obviously, they will use salt and olives and cheese, and they will boil the usual country dishes of wild roots and vegetables. And for dessert, we can offer them figs and chickpeas and beans. And they will roast myrtle berries and acorns in front of the fire, with a modest amount to drink. In this way, living lives which are peaceful and in all probability healthy, they will die in old age, handing down the same way of life to their descendants. If you were organising a city of pigs, Socrates, isn't that just how you would feed them? Well, what sort of meals should we give them, Glaucon? I asked. The kind we're used to. If they're going to eat in comfort, they should lie on couches, eat off tables, and have the cooked dishes and desserts which people today have. I see, I replied. So we're not just looking at the origin of a city, apparently. We're looking at the origin of a luxurious city. Maybe that's not such a bad idea. If we look at that sort of city, we may perhaps see the point where justice and injustice come into existence in cities. I think the true city, the healthy version, as it were, is the one we have just described. But let's look also at the swollen and inflamed city, if that is what you prefer. We can easily do that. What's to stop us? All this, and this way of life, will not, it seems, be enough for some people. They will have couches and tables and other furniture in addition, and cooked dishes, of course, and incense, perfumes, call girls, cakes, every variety of all these things. As for those needs we talked about at the beginning, we can no longer prescribe only the bare necessities, housing, clothing and shoes. We must introduce painting and decoration and start using gold and ivory and all those sorts of things, mustn't we? Yes. So, once again, we must enlarge our city, since our first healthy city is no longer big enough. We must fill it with a great mass and multitude of things which are no longer what cities must have as a matter of necessity. For example, we must have hunters of all kinds, artists, all those using figure and colour for their imitations, and those using music, poets and their assistants, reciters, actors, dancers, producers, and the makers of all sorts of goods, especially those used for making women look beautiful. What's more, we shall need more people in service. Don't you think we shall need attendants for our sons, wet nurses, nannies, hairdressers, barbers, not to mention cooks and chefs? And besides those, we shall need people to keep pigs as well. We didn't have them in our earlier city, since there was no need for them, but in this city there will be a need for them, as also for all sorts of other livestock, in case anyone wants them to eat. Isn't that right? Of course. And living like this, will we have much greater need of doctors than we did before? Yes, much greater. What is more, I imagine the territory, which was originally adequate to feed the original population, will no longer be adequate. It will be too small. Do we accept that? Yes. Do we need, then, to carve ourselves a slice of our neighbour's territory if we are going to have enough for pasturage and ploughing? And do they in turn need a slice of our land if they too give themselves up to the pursuit of unlimited wealth, not confining themselves to necessities? They're bound to, Socrates. And will the next step be war, Glaucon? Or what? War. Let us say nothing for the moment, I said, about whether the effect of war is harmful or beneficial. Let us merely note that we have discovered, in its turn, the origin of war. War arises out of those things which are the commonest causes of evil in cities, when evil does arise, both in private life and public life. Yes, our city needs to be even bigger, my friend, and not just a bit bigger. We must add to it a whole army which can go out and fight against invaders and defend all our wealth and the other things we were talking about just now. What about the citizens themselves? Aren't there enough of them? No, I said, not if we were right, you and the rest of us, in what we agreed earlier when we were forming our city. Surely we agreed, if you remember, that no individual was capable of practising several arts or skills properly. True. Well, how about fighting in battle, I asked. Don't you think that is essentially an art or skill? Very much so, he said. And should we regard the art of shoemaking as more important than the art of war? No. Well then, we didn't allow our shoemaker to try and be a farmer as well, or a weaver, or builder. He had to be a shoemaker to make sure the business of shoemaking was carried out properly. In the same way, we assigned a single task to each member of the other occupations, the task he was naturally suited to, and for which he would keep himself free from other tasks, working at it throughout his life and taking every opportunity to produce good results. Isn't it of the highest importance that warfare should be carried on as efficiently as possible? Or is war so easy that any farmer, any shoemaker, or any practitioner of any art or skill can be a soldier as well? Even to be a decent draughts or dice player, you have to have been playing since you were a child. It can't be done in your spare time. So how can you pick up a shield or any other weapon or instrument of war and immediately be equipped to take your place in the battle line, or in any of the other sorts of fighting which occur in time of war? Think of other instruments. There isn't one of them that will turn a person into a craftsman or athlete simply by being picked up, or that will be of any use to him if he has no expertise or has not had enough practice in handling it. No, he said. They'd be extremely valuable instruments if you could. Since the guardian's job, then, I said, is the most important, it must correspondingly call for the greatest freedom from other activities, together with the highest level of expertise and training. That's certainly my opinion, he said. And also, of course, a natural disposition suited to precisely this way of life? Of course. And it would be our job, apparently, if we are capable of it, to choose which dispositions and which kinds of dispositions were suited to the defence of the city. That would indeed be our job. Heavens, I said, that's a major responsibility we have taken upon ourselves. All the same, as far as our abilities permit, we must try not to back out of it. Yes, we must. Well then, I said, when it comes to acting as a guardian, don't you think that in his disposition a young man of good birth is like a young pedigree hound? In what way? Well, for example, each of them needs acute senses, speed in pursuit of what they detect, and strength as well, in case they catch it and have to fight with it. Yes, he said, they need all these qualities. Plus courage, of course, if he is to fight well. Of course. But is any living creature likely to be brave, whether horse or dog or anything else, if it doesn't have a spirited and energetic nature? Haven't you noticed what an irresistible and unconquerable thing spirit is? With spirit, any living creature is fearless and invincible in the face of any danger. Yes, I have noticed that. As for the physical characteristics required of a guardian, then, they are obvious. Yes, and the mental requirement is that he should be spirited or energetic. Yes, that too. And do you think the person who is going to be guardian material needs another quality as well? Do you want him, as well as being spirited and energetic, to be also, by temperament, a lover of wisdom, a philosopher? What do you mean? I don't understand. It's another thing you see in dogs, I replied, something which makes you wonder at the animal. What is that? When it sees someone it doesn't know, a dog turns nasty, even though it hasn't been badly treated by him in the past. When it sees someone familiar, it welcomes him, even if it has never been at all well treated by him. Haven't you ever found that rather remarkable? I'd never really thought about it up to now, he said, but I think there's no doubt a dog does behave like that. It seems clever, this side of his nature. It seems to show a true love of wisdom. In what way? Because, I replied, it classifies what it sees as friendly or hostile solely on the fact that it knows one and doesn't know the other. It must be a lover of knowledge if it defines friend and enemy by means of knowledge and ignorance. Yes, he said, it must. And are love of knowledge and love of wisdom or philosophy the same thing? They are. So can we say with some confidence of a man, too, that if he's going to be someone who is gentle towards those he knows and recognises, he must, by his nature, be a lover of knowledge and of wisdom? We can. Then will the person who is going to be a good and true guardian of our city be a lover of wisdom, spirited, swift, and strong? He certainly will. Very well, then, I said. What is the next question we have to decide? Isn't it which of these people are to rule and which be ruled? Unquestionably. Is it obvious the rulers should be older and those who are ruled younger? Yes, it is. And that the rulers should be the best among them? That too. Among farmers, aren't the best ones the ones who most possess the attributes of a farmer? Yes. So in this context, since we are looking for the best of the guardians, must they not be the ones who most possess the attributes of a guardian of the city? Yes. And for this purpose, do they have to be wise, powerful, and above all devoted to the city? They do. And people are most devoted to whatever it is they love. Bound to be. And they love most what they believe to have the same interests as themselves, the thing whose success or failure they think results in their own success or failure. True, he said. Then we must select from the guardians the kind of men who on examination strike us most strongly their whole lives through as being utterly determined to do what is in the city's interests, and as refusing to act in any way against its interests. Yes, they should be the people we want. I think we should observe them at all ages to make sure they are the guardians and defenders of this belief, and that neither magic nor force can make them forget and jettison their conviction that they should do what is best for the city. What do you mean by this jettisoning? He asked. I'll tell you, he said. I think our minds can lose a belief either with or without our consent. With our consent, when it's a false belief and we learn better, without our consent, in the case of all true belief. I understand the loss which is with our consent, but the loss which is without our consent, I need to have explained to me. Really? Don't you agree with me that what is good can be taken away from people only without their consent, whereas what is bad is taken away with their consent? Isn't being deceived about the truth something bad, and knowing the truth something good? And don't you think that having a belief which agrees with the way things are is knowing the truth? You're right. When people lose a true belief, it is without their consent. And is that a question of theft, or magic, or force? Once again, I'm afraid I don't see what you mean. I seem to be making myself about as clear as a tragic poet, I said. By theft, I mean people who are talked into changing their minds, and people who forget. Either the passage of time or some process of argument takes away their belief without them realising it. You do see what I mean now, I hope. Yes. By force, I mean those whom pain or grief causes to change their beliefs. Yes, I understand that as well, he said, "and I agree. As for magic, you would also accept, I imagine, that there are people whose beliefs change because they are seduced by pleasure, or because there is something they are afraid of. Yes, all the things which deceive us do look like a form of magic. So, as I said just now, we must look for those who are the best defenders of their conviction that in any situation they must do what they think is in the city's best interests for them to do. From their earliest childhood we must watch them and set them the kind of tasks which can make them lose sight of this aim and lead them astray. Then we must choose the ones who remember their aim and are not easily led astray. Those who are led astray we must reject, mustn't we? Yes. As a second type of test, we must give them hardship, pain, and trials, and in all of them look for the characteristics we want." "Correct," he said. "Then we must have a third type of test, a test for magic, and watch their reactions to that. Just like people taking young colts close to loud and confused noises, to find out if they are easily frightened, we must expose our guardians, when they are young, first to danger and then to pleasure. We must test them like gold in the fire, only more so. Does this one stand out in every situation as immune to magic and worthy of respect? Is he a good guardian of himself and the musical education he has received? Does he show qualities of rhythm and harmony in all the tests we set him? Is he the kind of person who would be the greatest use to himself and the city? From our children, from our young and grown men, the one who under constant testing emerges as pure is the one who should be appointed as a ruler and guardian of our city. We should heap honours on him in life and in death, and when it comes to burial and other memorials, he should receive the greatest tributes. The one who fails the tests, we should reject. Well, Glaucon, so much for my views on the selection and appointment of the rulers and guardians. It's only a general outline, of course, and not a precise specification. I think my views are pretty much the same as yours," he said. "In that case, aren't these really the people who can most accurately be called full guardians? Making sure friends within do not want to harm it, and enemies without are not able to harm it. The young people whom we have been calling guardians up to now we can call auxiliaries, the defenders of the ruler's beliefs." "I agree." "In that case," I said, "how can we contrive to use one of those necessary falsehoods? We want one single noble lie which will be believed by everybody, including the rulers, ideally, but failing that, the rest of the city." "What kind of thing do you mean?" "A very familiar story of Phoenician origin. In the past, so the poets tell us and we believe, it happened in several places, but it has not happened in our time, and I don't even know if it could happen. People would take a lot of persuading." "You seem a bit reluctant to tell your story," he said. "With good reason, as you will see when I do tell you." "Don't worry," he said. "Tell it." "Very well, I will, though I don't know how I shall have the nerve or find the right words. I have to try and persuade, first of all, the rulers themselves and the soldiers, and then the rest of the city, that the entire upbringing and education we gave them, their whole experience of it happening to them, was, after all, merely a dream, something they imagined, and that in reality they spent that time being formed and raised deep within the earth, themselves, their weapons, and the rest of the equipment which was made for them. When the process of making them was complete, the earth, their mother, released them, and now it is their duty to be responsible for defending the country in which they live against attack, just as they would defend their mother or nurse, and to regard the rest of the citizens as their brothers, born from the earth." "No wonder you were so embarrassed about telling us your lie." "Yes, I had good reason," I said, but you must listen to the second half of the story as well. You are all brothers, our story will tell them, all of you in the city, but when God made you, he used a mixture of gold in the creation of those of you who were fit to be rulers, which is why they are the most valuable. He used silver for those who were to be auxiliaries, and iron and bronze for the farmers and the rest of the skilled workers. Most of the time, you will father children of the same type as yourselves, but because you are all related, occasionally a silver child may be born from a golden parent, or a golden child from a silver parent, and likewise any type from any other type. The first and most important instruction God gives the rulers is that the thing they should be the best guardians of, the thing they should keep the most careful eye on, is the compound of these metals in the souls of the children. If their own child is born with a mixture of bronze or iron in him, they must feel no kind of pity for him, but give him the position in his society his nature deserves, driving him out to join the skilled workers or farmers. On the other hand, any children from those groups, born with a mixture of gold or silver, should be given recognition and promoted either to the position of guardian or to that of auxiliary. There is a prophecy, God tells them, that the end of the city will come when iron or bronze becomes its guardian. Well, that's the story. Can you think of any possible way of getting people to believe it? No, he said, not the actual people you tell it to, but their children might, and their children after them, and the rest of the population in later generations. Even that might help them to care more about the city and one another. I think I see what you're getting at. Anyway, let that turn out as popular belief and tradition will have it. Our job now is to arm these earth-born warriors of ours and lead them forth with the rulers at their head. Let them go and look for the best place in the city to put their camp, a place from which they can most easily control their own citizens, if any of them refuse to obey the laws or repel any external threats in the event of some enemy coming down on them like a wolf on the fold. When they have set up their camp, they can sacrifice to the appropriate gods and then organise their sleeping accommodation. Does that sound right? Yes, he said. Should it be the kind of accommodation which will give them adequate shelter both in winter and summer? Of course. This is their home you're talking about, I take it? Yes, I said, but a home fit for soldiers, not for businessmen. What is the difference in your view? I'll try and tell you. When shepherds are breeding dogs as protectors of their flocks, the worst possible disaster and disgrace, I imagine, is to breed dogs whose nature and training are such that lack of discipline, hunger, or some fault of character leads them to try to attack the sheep themselves and start behaving like wolves instead of dogs. Yes, of course, that's a disaster. In that case, we must guard in every way we can against our auxiliaries doing the same sort of thing to the citizens. After all, they are stronger than the citizens. We don't want them behaving like savage masters instead of friendly allies. Yes, we must guard against that, he said. Won't the best insurance against this be for them to have received a really good education? But they have received one, he said. And I said, we can't be sure of that, my dear Glaucon. What we can be sure about is what we have just been saying, which is that when it comes to gentleness, both to themselves and to those under their protection, then the right education, whatever that may be, is the key. Yes, we're right to be sure of that. In addition to this education, an intelligent observer may say, the guardian should be furnished with housing and a general standard of living which will not hinder them from becoming the best possible guardians, and which will give them no encouragement to do wrong in their dealings with the rest of the citizens. He may say that, and he'll be quite right. Well then, I said, do you agree with some suggestions about the way they should live and be housed, if this is what we want them to be like? In the first place, no one is to have any private property beyond what is absolutely essential. Secondly, no one is to have the kind of house or storeroom which cannot be entered by anyone who feels like it. For their subsistence, which should meet the needs of self-disciplined and courageous warrior athletes, they should impose a levy on the rest of the citizens, and receive an annual payment for their role as guardians, which leaves them with neither a surplus nor a deficiency. They should live a communal life, eating together like soldiers in camp. As for gold and silver, they should be told they already have in their souls all the time the divine gold and silver given to them by the gods. They have no need of human gold in addition, and it is sacrilege to contaminate the divine gold they possess by adding to it a mixture of the perishable gold, since the gold in circulation among ordinary people has been the cause of much evil, whereas their own gold is pure. To them alone, out of the city's population, is it forbidden to handle or touch gold or silver, or be beneath the same roof, or wear it as jewellery, or drink from gold or silver cups. In this way they will be kept safe, and they will keep the city safe. Once they start acquiring their own land, houses and money, they will have become householders and farmers instead of guardians. From being the allies of the other citizens, they will turn into hostile masters. They will spend their whole lives hating and being hated, plotting and being plotted against. Their fears of enemies inside the city will be much more numerous and more acute than their fears of enemies outside the city. Both they, themselves, and the city will be heading at full speed towards imminent destruction. For all these reasons, shall we say that our guardians are to be provided with the housing and way of life we have described? Are these the laws we should enact? Or not? They certainly are, said Glaucon. I take it our city, if it has been correctly founded, is wholly good. It can't help being. Clearly, then, it is wise, courageous, self-disciplined, and just. Clearly. Then, as we find each of these elements in it, those we have not yet found will constitute the remainder. Of course. With any four things, if we were looking for one of them in some place or other, and it was the first thing we caught sight of, that would be enough for us. But if we identified the other three first, then the one we were looking for would, ipso facto, have been identified as well, since clearly it could then only be whatever was left. You're right, he said. It's the same for us now. Since there actually are four elements, should we conduct our search in the same way? Yes, obviously. Well, I think the first one to catch the eye is wisdom, and it seems to have an unusual feature. What is that? It is truly wise, I think, this city we have described. It has good judgment, doesn't it? Yes. Now, this thing, judgment, is clearly knowledge of some sort. Good decisions, I take it, are the result of knowledge, not ignorance. Obviously. But our city contains many types of knowledge, of very different kinds. Of course it does. Is it the knowledge possessed by carpenters, which entitle us to call our city wise, and say it possesses good judgment? Certainly not, he said. That merely entitles us to call it good at carpentry. So a city is not to be called wise because of its knowledge and judgment in making the best possible wooden furniture. Absolutely not. How about its knowledge of making things out of bronze, or any other knowledge of that kind? No, nothing like that, he said. Nor the knowledge of how to grow crops from the soil, since that's called farming. So I believe. Is there, then, I asked, among any of the citizens of this city we have just founded, any branch of knowledge which makes decisions about the city as a whole, deciding on the best policy towards its own members and towards other states, and not about one particular element in the city? There most certainly is. What is this knowledge, and in which group is it to be found? It is the knowledge possessed by the guardians, he said, and it is to be found in the rulers, whom we have just been calling the perfect guardians. And what is the label you give your city on the strength of this knowledge? I call it sound in judgment and truly wise. So, which do you think our city will have more of? Metal workers or these true guardians? Metal workers, he said, far more. Of all the groups which have a branch of knowledge of their own, and which are identified as a group, wouldn't the guardians be the smallest? Easily the smallest. In which case, the wisdom of a city founded on natural principles depends entirely on its smallest group and element, the leading and ruling element, and the knowledge that element possesses. The class which can be expected to share in this branch of knowledge, which of all branches of knowledge is the only one we can call wisdom, is by its nature, apparently, the smallest class. That's very true, he said. Well, that's one of the four things we were looking for, and we've not only found it, I'm not quite sure how, but also found whereabouts in the city it is located. Nothing much wrong with the way it was found, as far as I'm concerned, he said. Courage next. It is not hard to see both the thing itself and the part of the city in which it is located, the part which gives the city the name Courageous. Explain. No one classifying a city as cowardly or brave would look at any other part of it than the part which makes war in the city's defence and serves in its army. Yes, that's the only part anyone would look at, he said. I think the reason for that, I said, is that the cowardice or bravery of the rest of the population would not be enough to make the city itself cowardly or brave. No, it wouldn't. That leaves two things for us to identify in our city, I said. One is self-discipline. The other is the object of our entire investigation. Justice. Yes. Well, is there some way we can find justice without having to bother about self-discipline? I don't know, he said. I wouldn't want it to make its appearance too soon, if that means giving up the search for self-discipline. If I have any say in the matter, please examine self-discipline first. Very well. My first impression is that it is more like a harmony or musical mode than the other two. In what way? Self-discipline, I take it, is a kind of order. They say it is a mastery of pleasures and desires, and a person is described as being in some way or other master of himself. And there are other clues of the same sort in the way it is talked about, aren't there? Indeed there are, he said. But isn't the phrase master of himself an absurdity? The master of himself must surely also be slave to himself, and the slave to himself must be master of himself. It's the same person being talked about all the time. Of course. What this way of speaking seems to me to indicate is that in the soul of a single person there is a better part and a worse part. When the naturally better part is in control of the worse, this is what is meant by master of himself. It is a term of approval. But when as a result of bad upbringing or bad company the better element is too small and is overwhelmed by the volume of the worse element, this is a matter for reproach. They call a person in this condition a slave to himself and undisciplined. Yes, I think that is what it indicates, he said. Now, if you take a look at this new city of ours, you will find one of these situations prevailing. You will admit that it can quite legitimately be called mistress of itself, if something in which the better rules the worse can be called self-disciplined and master of itself. Yes, when I take a look at our city, he said, you are right. But you also find the whole range and variety of desires, pleasures, and pains, particularly in children, women, slaves, and among so-called free men in the majority of ordinary people. You certainly do. Whereas simple, moderate desires, which are guided by rational calculation, using intelligence and correct belief, are things you come across only among a few people, those with the best natural endowment and the best education. True, he said. Well, do you see the same qualities in your city? Are the desires of the ordinary majority controlled by the desires and wisdom of the discerning minority? Yes, they are. So if any city can be called the mistress of its pleasures and desires and mistress of itself, this one can. It certainly can, he said. In which case, can't we also call it self-disciplined in all these respects? Very much so. What is more, if agreement is to be found among rulers and ruled in any city about which of them is to rule, it is to be found in this one. Don't you think? I couldn't agree more. Well then, when they agree in this way, in which of the two groups of citizens will you say the self-discipline is located, in the rulers or in the ruled? In both, I suppose. See what a plausible prediction we made just now, I said, when we compared self-discipline to a harmony of some sort. Explain. It is not the same as courage and wisdom. Each of those was located in a particular part, yet one of them made the whole city wise, and the other made it brave. Self-discipline does not operate in the same way. It extends literally throughout the entire city, over the whole scale, causing those who are weakest, in intelligence, if you like, or in strength, or again in numbers, wealth, or anything like that, together with those who are strongest, and those in between, to sing in unison. So we would be quite justified in saying that self-discipline is this agreement about which of them should rule, a natural harmony of worse and better, both in the city and in each individual. I quite agree, he said. Very well. Three of the qualities have been identified in our city, or such is our impression at any rate. What can the remaining quality be which allows a city to share in excellence? Because clearly this is going to be justice. Clearly. Now, Glaucon, this is the moment for us to position ourselves, like huntsmen in a ring round the thicket. We must concentrate and make sure justice does not escape. We don't want it to vanish and disappear from view. It's obviously here somewhere, so keep your eyes open and try your hardest to see where it is. If you see it first, give me a shout. Some hope, he said. No, I'm afraid the only help I'm going to be to you is if you want a follower, someone who can see things when they're pointed out to him. Say a prayer, then, and follow me. I will. Just you lead the way, he said. The place is impenetrable, I said, and full of shadows, and it's certainly dark. Not an easy place to dislodge our quarry from. Still, we must go on. Yes, we must. And then I caught sight of it. Ha-ha! Over here, Glaucon, I cried. This looks like the trail. I think our quarry is not going to escape us after all. That's good news, he said. We've been complete idiots. In what way? We're fine ones. It's been lying here under our noses all this time. The principle we laid down right at the start when we first founded our city as something we must stick to throughout. This, I think, or some form of it, is justice. The principle we laid down, and often repeated, if you remember, was that each individual should follow, out of the occupations available in the city, the one for which his natural character best fitted him. Yes, we did say that. And we have often heard others say, and have often said ourselves, that doing one's own job and not trying to do other people's jobs for them is justice. Yes, we have said that. Well, it looks, my friend, as if in some way or other, justice is this business of everyone performing his own task. Do you know what makes me think that? No? Tell me. I think the remaining element in the city, besides the virtues we've been looking at, self-discipline, courage and wisdom, is the thing which gave all the others the power to come into being, and the thing whose continued presence keeps them safe once they have come into being. We said earlier that justice would be the one left over if we could only find the other three. Yes, it would have to be, he said. Now, if we had to decide, I said, which of these elements would do most to make our city good by its inclusion, that would be a difficult decision. Is it the agreement of the rulers and the ruled? Or the preservation in the ranks of the warriors of an opinion approved by law about which things are to be feared and which are not? Or the wisdom and protectiveness we find in the rulers? Or does the largest contribution to making the city good come from the presence, in child and woman, slave and free man, in skilled craftsman, ruler and ruled, of the principle that each single individual is to perform his own task without troubling himself about the tasks of others? Yes, that would be a difficult decision, he said. Bound to be. So, as a means of producing an excellent city, the ability of everyone to perform his own function is apparently a strong competitor with the city's wisdom, self-discipline, and courage. Very much so. Now, see if you agree with me about the next step. If a carpenter tried to do the job of a shoemaker, or a shoemaker the job of a carpenter, either because they exchanged tools and positions in society, or because one person tried to do both jobs, do you think in general that changes of this sort would do much harm to the city? No, not really, he said. But I imagine it's different when someone who is naturally a skilled worker or businessman of some kind is puffed up by wealth, popularity, strength, or something like that, and tries to enter the warrior class, or when one of the warriors tries to enter the decision-making and guardian class without being up to it. If these people exchange tools and positions in society, or if one person tries to do all these jobs at the same time, then I think you will agree with me that this change and interference on their part is destructive to the city. Yes, it certainly is. It is the interference of our three classes with one another, then, and interchange between them, which does the greatest harm to the city and can rightly be called the worst crime against it. Absolutely. Isn't injustice the name for the greatest crime against one's own city? Of course. That, then, is what injustice is. Conversely, its opposite, the ability of the commercial, auxiliary and guardian classes to mind their own business, with each of them performing its own function in the city, this will be justice, and will make the city just. Yes, I think that's exactly how it is, he said. And is a just man just, Glaucon, in the same way a city was just? He is. We haven't at any point forgotten, I hope, that the city was just when each of the three elements in it was performing its own function. No, I don't think we've forgotten that, he said. In that case, we must also remember that each one of us will be just and perform his own proper task when each of the elements within him is performing its proper task. Yes, we must certainly remember that. Isn't it appropriate for the rational element to rule because it is wise and takes thought for the entire soul, and appropriate for the spirited element to be subordinate, the ally of the rational element. Yes? Won't a combination, as we said, of musical and physical education make these two elements concordant? They will bring the rational part to a higher pitch with their diet of improving stories and studies, while at the same time toning down the spirited part by gentle encouragement, calming it by means of harmony and rhythm. They certainly will, he said. When these two elements are brought up on a diet of this kind, when they truly receive the teaching and education appropriate to them, then the two of them will exercise control over the desiring element, which in any individual is the largest element in the soul, and left to itself the most insatiable where material goods are concerned. They will keep a close eye on it to make sure the satisfaction of the body's so-called pleasures doesn't encourage it to grow great and strong, stop performing its own function, and throw the life of all of them into confusion by its attempt to enslave and rule over elements which it is not naturally equipped to rule over. They will indeed, he said, a very close eye. Aren't these two elements also the best defenders, for body and soul in their entirety, against external enemies? One makes the decisions, the other does the fighting, under the leadership of the ruling element, using its courage to put those decisions into effect. True. The title brave, I think, is one we give to any individual because of this part of him, when the spirited element in him, though surrounded by pleasures and pains, keeps intact the instructions given to it by reason about what is to be feared and what is not to be feared. Rightly so, he said. And the title wise, because of that small part which acted as an internal ruler and gave those instructions, having within it a corresponding knowledge of what was good, both for each part and for the whole community of the three of them together. Exactly. What about self-discipline? Isn't that the result of the friendship and harmony of these three? The ruling element and the two elements which are ruled agree that what is rational should rule and do not rebel against it. Yes, that's exactly what self-discipline is, he said, both for a city and for an individual. And a person will be just, finally, by virtue of the principle we have several times stated. It determines both the fact and the manner of his justice. Yes, inevitably. In that case, I said, do we find justice looking at all blurred round the edges? Does it seem any different to us from what it was when it showed up in the city? Not to me, it doesn't. In which case, do you still want justice to be anything more than this power which can produce both men and cities of this calibre? No, that's more than enough for me, he said. In that case, we have seen the final realisation of our dream. Our suspicion that our very first attempt at founding our city might possibly, with a bit of divine guidance, have hit upon both the origin and some sort of model of justice. Yes, we certainly have seen its realisation. So this principle, Glaucon, that if you are a shoemaker by nature, you should confine yourself to making shoes, if you are a carpenter, you should confine yourself to carpentry, and so on, really was a kind of image of justice, which is why it was so useful to us. Apparently so. But the truth is that although justice apparently was something of this kind, it was not concerned with the external performance of a man's own function, but with the internal performance of it, with his true self and his own true function, forbidding each of the elements within him to perform tasks other than its own, and not allowing the classes of thing within his soul to interfere with one another. He has, quite literally, to put his own house in order, being himself his own ruler, mentor, and friend, and tuning the three elements just like three fixed points in a musical scale, top, bottom, and intermediate. And if there turn out to be any intervening elements, he must combine them all and emerge as a perfect unity of diverse elements, self-disciplined and in harmony with himself. Only then does he act, whether it is a question of making money or taking care of his body or some political action or contractual agreements with private individuals. In all these situations, he believes and declares that a just and good action is one which preserves or brings about this state of mind, wisdom being the knowledge which directs the action. An unjust action, by contrast, is any action which tends to destroy this state of mind, ignorance, in its turn, being the opinion which directs the unjust action. You're absolutely right, Socrates. Well then, I said, if we were to say we had found the just man, and the just city, and what justice really was in them, we couldn't be said to be totally wide of the mark, in my view. The only question now remaining for us to answer, it seems, is which is more profitable. Just actions, good behaviour, and being just, whether the just person is known to be just or not, or unjust actions, and being unjust, even if the unjust person gets away with it and never reforms as a result of punishment. Now that justice and injustice have turned out to be the kinds of things we've described, that seems an absurd question, if you want my opinion, Socrates. When the body's natural constitution is ruined, life seems not worth living, even with every variety of food and drink and all manner of wealth and power. Is someone's life going to be worth living when the natural constitution of the very thing by which he lives is upset and ruined, even assuming he can then do anything he likes, apart from what will release him from evil and injustice and win him justice and virtue? You're right, I said. It's an absurd question. Still, now that we've got to the point of being able to see as clearly as possible that this is how things are, this isn't the moment to take a rest. No, he said, the last thing we should do is to show any hesitation. This way, then, if you want to see what I believe to be the forms taken by vice, the ones worth looking at, anyway. I am right behind you, he said. Speak on. Well, now that we've got this far in our discussion, I said, it looks, from my vantage point, as if there is a single form of virtue and any number of forms of vice, of which four are worth mentioning. Please explain, he said. If you think how many types of political regime there are with their own specific form, I said, that's probably how many types of soul there are. And how many is that? Five types of political regime, I said, and five types of soul. Tell me which they are, he said. All right. I would say that one type of regime is this one we have just described, though there are two names it might be given. It might be called monarchy if one exceptional individual emerges among the rulers, or aristocracy if several emerge. True. This one, then, I class as a single form, I said. It makes no difference whether it is several who emerge or an individual. Given the upbringing and education we have described, they would not disturb any of the important laws of the city. No, that wouldn't be sensible, he said. I was about to embark on a systematic account of the way I thought the various categories developed out of one another, when Polymarchus, who was sitting a little bit away from Adamantus, reached out a hand and took hold of his cloak up at the shoulder. Drawing Adamantus towards him, he leaned forward and started whispering to him. All we could hear of it was, "What shall we do? Shall we let it go?" "No," Adamantus replied out loud. "What, in particular," I asked, "do you not want to let go?" "You! What in particular that I have said?" "We think you're taking the lazy way out," short-changing us out of a whole line of thought, and an important one, in the argument. To save yourself the trouble of explaining it. You think that when it comes to women and children, you can get away with a casual remark to the effect that friends will hold things in common, as if no one could be in any doubt about this. Wasn't what I said correct, then, Adamantus?